Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot. We charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Welcome to another episode of Mostly Lit. I'm here with
Derek Owusu.
And I would say Alex, but Alex is away.
He's away. He's gone to a christening.
Yeah.
Gone to get drunk at a christening.
Is that what they do to get drunk at christenings?
Everybody gets drunk at christenings.
Oh, that's haram. That's not going down in my place. I mean, there's no christenings, but that's not happening.
Is there a similar thing though in Islam?
I don't know if it's, well, actually, so you know how, like, in Islam, there are things that you should do. There are things that you should do that you're, like, it's mandatory to do.
And those, like, things, the pillars or...
Pillars are mandatory.
Yeah.
And it's called, and, like, praying and stuff. But then there are things that's called sunnah, where, like, the Prophet did that I think you can do. Mm-hmm. So in Islam, a baby gets named on the seventh day.
Yeah.
And on that seventh day, a lot of, like, certain things, like, it's a celebration and stuff.
Yeah.
So I guess that's a christening.
Yeah, I guess
but
it is, yeah, of course.
The christening
is, yeah.
Of, like, when a baby is born... Mm-hmm. The first thing that's supposed to happen is, you know, the adhan, the call to prayer.
Mm-hmm.
That is whispered in the kid's ear, so it's the first thing that they hear when they're born.
Really?
Yeah. So the first thing they hear is God is great.
Yeah.
Every time a kid is born, like the dad will like go to the side holding and just whisper those words in his ear.
It's literally like in the hospital.
Yeah, like straight. You have to do it straight away.
That wow. Okay.
I mean, it's so amazing.
That is.
So
anyway, yeah.
That's a little.
So let's introduce our.
Yeah, we have an amazing co-host with us today. Please introduce yourself, because I can't even do you justice.
Hey, everybody. This is Patrice Khan Colors, hailing from Los Angeles, one of the co-founders of Black Lives Matter. And I just wrote a book called When They Call You a Terrorist, a Black Lives Matter Memoir with my co-author, Asha Bendele. I'm here with the crew, Mostly Lit crew.
Yeah, thanks for joining us.
Yeah, like yesterday I said to everyone yesterday, I was like, we're having an amazing guest tomorrow.
All right. Yeah, we did, yeah.
And like when I saw that email pop, I said, what? Yeah. So thank you so much for being here. Honestly, like I'm in awe.
Oh,
like you have
sense.
Like...
You've come to fangirl.
I have. I was telling her like before, I was like, I think I might fangirl. No, because like Black Lives Matter has just changed the game, I think, in terms of like putting issues out there in the open and not being apologetic and just being like, this is the shit that is going down.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And we just no longer stand for it. Like, we're just not here for it.
Mm.
And I think that's amazing.
Thank you
for like doing that. You know, it must not be easy with all the like, the criticisms and just all of those things that I see. It must not be easy.
Exactly,
to
with the title of your book, When They Call You a Terrorist.
Exactly.
That must have been, I mean, I remember when I first heard that they were calling Black Lives Matter a terrorist organization, it's kind of just like, what?
Yeah.
It's really confusing.
Yeah.
I mean, so it must have been extremely, you've written about it, it's extremely frustrating and you're just kind of like, what the fuck?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Do you know what I mean?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it was disturbing. It was, I think for us and for me, and I'll read a segment of the book that talks a little bit about it, but I just understood that the moment that they started calling us terrorists and a terrorist organization, that they were trying to create a situation where they could shut down our movement, arrest our folks. And this has happened time and time again in Black-led movements across the globe, right? Where our folks end up being labeled terrorist, or we end up being labeled unpatriotic. And so this was, you know, Black Lives Matter, the moment where we started to be seen as enemies of the state.
But before we get stuck on, we'd have to do that in the normal, like,
stuck in, stuck in.
Can you just...
It's the term is stuck in.
He does this all the time.
I'm teaching you the idioms.
Wow. What, because, like, English isn't my first language?
Yeah, stuck in. Stuck on, stuck in.
You know what, from now on, I'm going to say stuck on.
Okay, fine.
Thank you, just so that I can... Different. Anyways, how's your week, Derek?
The week's been good. It's been all right, yeah. Obviously, leading up to the live show.
Yeah.
And then... tomorrow we're going to go and watch A Wrinkle in Time.
Yeah, really excited
about
that.
Which should be great as well. Nothing. Oh, we had the live show, which was good.
That thing happened.
which was good. Good fun. Great turnout. Again, obviously, thanks to everybody who came down to support.
Thanks
you know.
To Waterstones for, like, hosting.
Yeah, I always say, like, it's strange that people really come down to Waterstones just to listen to us chat shit about books.
Yeah.
It's weird. But, I mean, they do, ridiculous. So.
I was looking outside, looking at everyone. I was like, what?
Yeah.
Like, you mean you travel? People are like, yeah, I traveled all the way from Manchester. I traveled from, like...
From Birmingham, yeah.
Birmingham. And I was just like, whoa.
Yeah,
that's insane.
It was one thing I was trying to avoid, because I say so many controversial things up on the stage. Mm-hmm. When we finished, I tried to sneak out the back so that no one would...
try and talk to you.
No, not that I didn't want them to talk to me, but I knew there was going to be like, well, what you said with about this, I don't agree with it.
Yeah.
And then I'd kind of be stuck.
Yeah.
And of course it happened.
Uh-huh.
And they came for me.
What
and
did they say?
They circled me. Because of what I said about Black Panther, they didn't like it.
Oh, yeah.
Nobody
likes that.
They really came to circle me. But I mean, yeah, it was fun. Yeah. Week's been fine. And yeah, just reading and blah, 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 blah.
Patrice, how was your week? Like, I know you have been busy.
Well, I landed here, I think, on Thursday. I think.
You think?
The days. Because y'all are a day ahead of us. So I landed here and hit the ground running.
Mm.
I did BBC with... No, wait. That's not... I didn't do BBC. I did Channel 4 with Jon Snow.
Mm-hmm. Oh, wow, okay.
And then I did Hard Talk,
mm-hmm.
Which will be interesting. I'm curious what y'all think about that segment. Then I tried to go to sleep,
mm-hmm.
but I didn't. I went to bed at 4 in the morning, woke up at 5:30, went and did Good Morning Britain.
Yeah,
I don't know if you saw that, where I rolled my whole eyes on the show. I was that's how tired I was.
Yeah.
One of the people that anchors asked me about All Lives Matter. He was a fine anchor, but I rolled all my eyes, and
I was
embarrassed because I rolled my eyes on national television. It was very obvious.
I think a couple of people have done that on Good Morning Britain.
Wait, Chimamanda did that on a US show, didn't she?
No, it was a UK show.
Was it a UK show?
Yeah, yeah.
Now it's like a whole meme, just her
rolling her eyes.
That's basically how I found out I rolled my eyes. Yeah. Someone put it on Twitter and was like, look at Patrice.
I love it.
Rolled her all
I'm gonna
eyes.
I'm going to go and find it. It's going to be my backdrop now.
And then I just did a bunch of press yesterday and closed the night off at WOW event.
Yeah,
at
South Bank, yeah.
At South Bank Center at 8 p.m. I think by that time I was just like...
That's it.
It was just the raw me. People got the raw cursing on stage and everything. It's been
that's
lovely.
That's the best. Those are the best kind of interviews and talks, you know.
Yeah. When you're just tired of it.
Exactly, like... you know. The public image drops and you're just yourself. And you just...
Someone was laughing because they're like, you were leaning on stage and you had your shawl on holding yourself. Yeah. I was tired trying to keep it together.
So yeah, that's
how the week has been.
What about you, though, Ray? How you been?
Week's been hellish because of work and stuff, but otherwise... I'm a bit exhausted. I feel like I need to sleep.
Mm.
Even when I went home, I didn't really sleep. I was just up,
trying
to read up on things.
When does it get to a point at work where, like, you stop being the send-out? Do you know what I mean? I'm not saying the send-out as in you go get coffee, but to the point where they can't message you at 6 in the morning and say, come in at 7. When does that stop? Or does it never stop?
I think once I finish my training contract.
Right.
So in around 18 months.
Wow.
Obviously, I'm just moving into seats, but you're never really a call. Like, nobody ever tells you to go and get coffee or anything.
Yeah, of course.
But it's more so like I'll get an email at like 2 a.m. being like, oh, we really need you early in tomorrow. And I'm like, well, how am I going to find, like, I'm not going to be awake at that time to know that.
Yeah.
So that happened one of them this week, and I had to get an Uber into work because I woke up, like, getting ready. And then I see the messages, oh, please get in for 8. I was like, well, it's 7:30.
Do you get in trouble if you don't? Or do they get a bit funny with
you? They'll just be like, you should have checked. But I'm like, that's unreasonable. So, yeah, being a trainee lawyer is tough.
Yeah.
Oh, you're a trainee lawyer.
It's mad. I worked for like, I think, 17, 18 hours on Tuesday.
What?
Yeah, so I got into work at 8 and I left around 3, 4.
Do you get paid overtime?
No, you just get a salary.
Wow. That's
yeah, so I'm actually exhausted. I feel like I was, like yesterday at the show, I was running on adrenaline.
Yeah.
And as soon as the show finished, I crashed.
Did you have to sign a waiver when you first started to say, you're contracted for this amount of hours, but we can tell
you
to...
Yeah, that's the contract. It's more so like, your contract is for like 9:30 to 5:30, but it's when the client needs you. You just have to, you know, make it work.
Okay.
But yeah, man, like I'm crashing right now. The adrenaline is just
still there. Yeah.
I literally cannot. I'm jittery because I'm like I'm happy, but then I'm also really tired.
Yeah, yeah.
So I'm like, hi. So hopefully it'll get better.
So you're not reading anything. We'll start with you. So what are you reading?
What am I reading? I'm still reading Children of Blood and Bone.
Oh yes.
But. Mm. I don't even want to finish it, to be honest with you.
Is it that good?
I think it's that good.
Wow.
I really think it's that good. And I, it's rare for me to... Like, normally when I get stuck in a book, I go crazy. And then halfway through, I'm like, it's not really that good.
Yeah.
But this time, I'm like, it's still good.
It's still good, yeah.
Like, it's... And
that's always a nice feeling.
Yeah, like, I'm actually shocked because I'm a bit of a pessimist when I go into books. I'm always like, oh, is this going to be a waste of my time?
Especially when there's a lot of hype.
Exactly.
But this time you're saying the hype is justified.
I feel like she's done something big, especially for young black kids. I don't want to say too much because I think I have already and I keep on reiterating the same thing.
It's fine.
But she's done a big thing.
Mm.
And I feel like that story is going to get kids excited. I hope kids really read it. I feel like every parent, carer, should just be getting young black kids.
You must love it a lot. You're smiling a lot.
I am. Because I'm so like, I'm just imagining myself reading this. I needed to read this.
Oh, you're imagining reading it as a child.
The excitement, the magic of it is just.
What is it called again? I forget.
Children of Blood and Bone.
Okay, I'm gonna go. I've been seeing it on my Insta.
Yeah,
but...
yeah.
No, it's. I think it needs to be read.
Okay.
I just want everyone to read it so this girl can get her coin, more coin.
What about you, Patrice? You reading anything at the moment?
I'm reading. Eloquent Rage by Brittany Cooper. She's she also got published with, and on the U.S. side, St. Martin's Press. We have the same publisher, and she's a brilliant black feminist who you should follow her on social. Hilarious. She actually created the Crunk Feminist Collective, and she just wrote a book called Eloquent Rage, really mapping black woman's rage and how important it is.
Ooh.
And it's just. Lovely. And she's on, I think she just finished her book tour or she may still be on it. And then I'm reading some that haven't been published yet. Just some books that my folks are about to publish. This is like the year of black authors.
This is it.
Right.
And I feel like it's both the stateside and the British side as well.
Yeah. Yeah.
Like a lot of black women are just doing amazing things on each, like on either side of like the Atlantic.
Yeah. True. I mean, even what I'm reading at the moment is kind of like just a little sampler.
Yeah.
You know, the Slay in Your Lane sampler. Yeah. So it's like, people who aren't familiar with it, Slay in Your Lane is like the black girl Bible written by two best friends, Yomi Adegoke and Elizabeth Uvenevene. I struggle to pronounce the name. It's easy, but it's hard. But yes, it's just amazing. There's like a dating chapter in there where they're literally talking about black British men who prefer to date white women.
Oh, no.
And the way they articulate that. And it's always like a put down to black women before they can, do you know what I mean? And it's really interesting. I think that when the book comes out, although it's obviously the black girl Bible, Slay in Your Lane, I think a lot of men will read it and kind of wake up and just be like, okay, you know what? We're fucking up right now. Do you know what I mean? Because I really do... I really enjoy books like that that kind of make me like turn in on myself and just think, okay, wow, I actually do this thing and I didn't realize that I did it. I had the same feeling when I read The Will to Change, and I read it and I was kind of like, wow, like no one has kind of articulated this kind of experience.
You're putting Slay Your Lane next to
Yeah, of course. Why not? I mean, any book that makes you really turn in on yourself and think about your behavior and the way you act towards other people. So it's a great book. Just, I mean, that's what it's supposed to do. But yeah, that's what I'm reading at the moment. It's just two. It's a two chapter sampler. The book obviously comes out in July, so I can't wait to read it. But yeah, that's what I've been reading. I haven't had time. That's why I've had to pick up the samplers more. So yeah, but yeah. So moving on.
Stuck in.
To the main topic.
There's, because we don't have Alex.
Yeah, no Alex today.
Yeah.
So Patrice, would you like to just read an excerpt from the book for us?
There was a petition that was drafted and circulated all the way to the White House. It said we were terrorists. We who, in response to the killing of that child, said Black Lives Matter. The document gained traction during the first week of July 2016 after a week of protests against the back-to-back police killings of Alton Sterling in Baton Rouge and Philando Castile in Minneapolis. At the end of that week, on July 7th in Dallas, Texas, a sniper opened fire during a Black Lives Matter protest that was populated with mothers and fathers who brought their children along to proclaim, "We have a right to live." The sniper, identified as 25-year-old Micah Johnson, an Army reservist home from Afghanistan, holed up in a building on the campus of El Centro College after killing five police officers and wounding 11 others, including two protesters. And in the early morning hours of July 8th, 2016, he became the first individual ever to be blown up by local law enforcement. They used a military-grade bomb against Micah Johnson and programmed a robot to deliver it to him. No jury, no trial, no patience like the patience shown the killers who gunned down nine worshippers in Charleston or moviegoers in Aurora, Colorado. Of course, we will never know what his motivations really were, and we will never know if he was mentally unstable. We will only know for sure that the single organization to which he ever belonged was the U.S. Army. And we will remember that white men who were mass killers in Aurora and Charleston were taken alive, and one was fed fast food on the way to jail. We will remember that most of the cops who are killed in this nation are killed by white men who are taken alive.
Thank you. Amazing. You know, it's so strange sitting next to you and hearing you read it, because I've listened to the audiobook. So it's really weird.
Wait.
You're like, I've heard that voice.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, yeah. But great. Thank you. I just wanted to ask, at what point did you decide that I need to write a book and document all of this?
That was going to be my first question too.
Well, someone actually came up to me in 2015. I was on Martha's Vineyard. Had the first time ever going to Martha's Vineyard. I'm so ridiculous that when I first got invited to Martha's Vineyard, I assumed I was in California. And I remember someone who was booking my travel, I was like, you know, I thought it was going to be like a same day flight. And she was like, girl, this is in the East Coast. And I was like, I didn't know. So I got to Martha's Vineyard. It's a very interesting place in the U.S. It's where the first pilgrims landed, first colonizers. Okay. And Plymouth Rock is there. And black folks have been going to Martha's Vineyard since the 60s. So it's also like this place where it's like a big black population, and they do this like big film festival, and they do this big events every summer. So it's kind of like the in thing. I had no idea until I got there. So I get there and I ended up on a panel. This is before Issa Rae blew up. I'm on a panel with Issa Rae and the actor Danny Glover. And after I'm done, editor from a big publishing house comes up to me and said, I think you have a book inside of you. It's like one of those moments. And I said, oh yeah, okay, cool. And I had a meeting with her the next day, and I kept it pushing. I was like, I'm gonna go back to doing what I do, you know, go organize and be on the grind of Black Lives Matter. But then as the presidential elections started to unfold itself, and Trump and Hillary and all the folks who were running, and the circus started to sort of develop, I was like, I think this might be an important moment to really clarify what Black Lives Matter is. And then obviously, once they started calling us terrorist organization, I was like, okay.
It's a must.
This is necessary. Yeah. I didn't actually go with that publisher, but she really planted the seed that I should publish.
Okay. So what was the writing process like?
I think the other good question is like why I chose to get a co-author, because different people decide different things. I called my good friend Dream Hampton. I go to my friends for good counsel, and she said, I said, do you think I should write this book? Because I was worried, you know, I was like, why would I write a book? Like, there's lots of people in our movement. Why is it important? Why is it necessary? I don't want to be seen as like the you know, we are really against like this idea of like one individual leader. Will this sort of go against my beliefs? And so I had a lot to kind of struggle with.
Yeah.
And so I went to Dream. I said, should I write a book? And she said, absolutely, you should. You know, lots of people can write books, Patrice. You don't have to like feel like if you write the book, then people are going to be upset about it. So she said, you should go talk to Asha because Asha has written like 6 books. I said, okay. So I go to Asha. Mm-hmm. And I'm like talking to her. I was like, so, you know, someone told me that I should write this book. And what do you think? And she interrupted me. She's like, I'm helping you. Like, mm-hmm. hands down, I got you. Like, we go about write the most fire book ever. When you meet Asha, you'll see. She's hella gully. She's like, we gonna write the most fire book. She's from, like, Brooklyn. And she's like, I got you, girl. I got you. And she was serious. Like, she's like, set me on a schedule. And we were basically meeting, like, every single morning. Pretty much 5 days a week.
Oh, wow. You know,
my 6 o'clock in the morning, her 9 a.m. And we would talk and we would write and we would talk and we would write. Yeah. And we had, you know, running Google Doc. We wrote the actual proposal probably in like a 3 month span.
Mm.
And then we got it. We went into a bidding war. Mm. Never, ever been a part of that kind of process before. It was quite fascinating.
Mm.
And
then, everyone wanted. Everyone was like, oh.
Yeah, I had a lot of offers. I was very, very blessed, very grateful.
Yeah.
And a lot of black women editors who were like, oh, this is the book, yeah, I've been waiting for, you, yeah, know? Because they got to edit a lot of stuff. But I ended up going with St. Martin's with Monique Patterson, who's an amazing editor. And they asked us to get it to them. We gave them the proposal in March. They wanted it by the summer, which is,
oh, wow,
crazy.
That's a quick turnaround.
How much had you written at that point?
4 chapters.
Oh, man.
Okay.
So we wrote our asses off.
Mm.
Yeah, we went in. We went real in. Some days I'd be like, Asha, I can't do it. Because it's intense. The book, yeah, is intense. It's not like no light read, yeah, you know? Which means I had to really like unearth the shit I've been through and talk about it and process it and write about it and... had lots of therapy appointments during that time, and mm, and but we did it, and I'm very, very, very proud of the work.
Mm.
Yeah, very proud of it.
Just going back to what you were saying about the things that you had to drudge up, yeah, to be able to really write about it properly and honestly, you obviously talk a lot about your childhood in this book, and one of the things that hit me was the schools that you went to and the different types of schools, mm-hmm, that were there. You know, there was, where is it? Millikan. Millikan, right? Mm-hmm. And the different types of schools that were there. I think, you know, the one school that looked like a prison.
Yeah.
And the other school that looked like a school.
Yeah.
And it's so weird, like, thinking about London schools. I don't know what school in London has, like, metal detectors. Do you think they're about?
No, of course. I don't think any school that I've been to,
yeah,
has metal detectors, but obviously that's just because difference in like,
yeah,
in gun laws and things like, yeah, that. There's no need, but obviously like the way you contrasted, you know, the white school with the black schools, when, mm, realistically the way you put it was the white schools probably needed policing. More than the black. Do you know what I mean? Which was like, yeah, really, really interesting. One thing I wanted to ask is that, because there's so much, there's a lot of trauma in the book,
yeah,
and you know, when you writing about your father and when you got the call, and then obviously, you know, your brother, I just wanted to ask, what was the hardest thing for you to write about?
I think the hardest chapter was the chapter unearthing and having to remember my brother going into the courtroom,
mm,
and he was in the middle of that manic episode, and they brought him in on a gurney with a spit mask. And I think that was like the hardest chapter to write about, mostly because outside of actually being in that situation in that courtroom with my friends, I had not really processed that moment. I think, you know, it happened. My mother and I sort of dealt with it.
Yeah.
My friends were in the courtroom with me. But having to write about it and tell someone else about it was just challenging. And mean, just so sad. Mm-hmm. And also because my brother, you know, he still struggles with mental illness. He's going to struggle with it for the rest of his life. His, just knowing what he's been through and what he continues to go through.
Yeah.
That was really hard.
Yeah.
I feel like I sensed a lot of humiliation that American law enforcement put on Black lives to the point where you begin to maybe think that you're lesser than mm-hmm. when an organization that is there to protect you is now something that you actively fear, even if you have done absolutely nothing wrong.
Yeah.
And I think the perpetuation of that, like, it really makes me sad in that where are we going to see a change if the attitudes towards Black people in law enforcement is not changing? And how do we go about changing that?
Yeah.
Like, how do we go about changing that?
We're in it. I don't think it happens overnight. The unfortunate reality is law enforcement, I think not just in the States, but across the world, is a law enforcement that's created to police and militarize and occupy Black and brown communities. And so law enforcement isn't created for rich, wealthy people unless it's to protect them from, you know,
yeah.
Black and brown people. It's not to police them. It's not to repress them. Yeah, so part of the work is to demyth the ways in which law enforcement has been seen as a hero. And so I don't know what UK TV is like, but in the US we have 15 million cop shows, and every cop show is about a hero cop, you know,
yeah.
and what he's doing. And even with the crooked cops, it's a hero cop that stops a crooked cop. And so there's this thing that has happened over the last 20 years where law enforcement has been glorified, and they can be terrible people, right? But they can be seen as terrible people or portrayed as terrible people on television, but they also have complicated lives. They're allowed to seem as complicated, and this is the reason why they're terrible. And so that's the first work, right? Is to we had to remind the public that cops lie. Cops plant shit on people. Mm-hmm. Cops, you know, rape people, and like really clarify what's happening in our neighborhoods. And I think the second piece is law enforcement is the most protected government agency. And the next step is around what kinds of laws and policies do we have to develop that take their power away.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I was talking to a friend about how a lot of the times the reason why, you know, if a cop gets, you know, on trial, and you already know the outcome, that they're going to be found not guilty. Mm. And it's that...
if it even goes that far.
Right? Mm-hmm. And if it's that idea of, oh, you know, they had a reasonable amount of fear, which is why they shot this Black man or killed this Black woman. And I think the discussion is, where does that fear come from? And what is reasonable fear? If reasonable fear is, you know, if the fear is you are scared of a Black person, that's not reasonable. That's just you being absolutely damn racist. Mm-hmm. And you need to address that fear and stop yourself. Or I don't know what kind of training, some unbiased training or that they will give these people that will allow them to be like, you know what, you need to address your fear and see where your fear comes from, because your fear is costing people's lives.
Yeah. I don't, it's not like the UK where, for example, a police officer has kind of like some racist sentiments in the station, they go and put them on diversity training. I don't think that happens in the US, probably because the way they see Black people and the racism, like you always talk about, you're talking a lot about, I believe, was it Hillary Clinton who coined the phrase?
Super predator.
Yeah, exactly.
She popularized it. I don't know if she coined it.
Okay, yeah. That's in their minds. Do you know what I mean? So it's very, very different. So a lot of the time when I read your book, and when I read like Huey Newton and Assata Shakur, it's really...
Did you read the autobiography?
Sorry?
Did you read the autobiography?
Yeah.
Oh, that was good.
Yeah, it's amazing. It's such a shock you know, it's such a shock. And I get angry and I feel all of these kind of emotions and things like that. And then when you see riots on TV, you know, I'm obviously behind my computer tweeting stuff. And then I have to really check myself and be like,
normally, being a little extra might be a bit much, but not when it comes to healthcare. That's why UnitedHealthcare's Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, supplement your primary plan so you manage out-of-pocket costs. Learn more at uh1.com.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass? So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Well, I'm not there. I haven't experienced it. You know, I was really annoyed by a lot of people saying that, oh, these people, you know, they're going and they're burning down their neighborhoods, but at the end of the day, they're going to, you know, they're going to have to walk through these neighborhoods. And I'm just like, okay, fair, but we're in the comforts of our home tweeting this stuff and they're experiencing it. Do you know what I mean? You can't really tell people, do you know what I mean? We're not the ones there. One thing I did want to ask you is your relationship with your father. Do you feel like you never really lost hope in him because you understood the economic situation that he was living in and the way, obviously, the police treat you, the way America's made, you know, not made black men a certain way, but it's contributed to the way that they behave?
Mm-hmm. Well, it's a good question because one of the moments that my father was sent to prison, I think it was that moment when my mom told me, and I was in high school, I actually was very upset with him.
Mm.
Very upset with him. And I called my other father, Alton Cullors, and I said, you know, I'm very upset with Gabriel, and I was kind of processing with him, and he stopped me, which is rare. He usually gives me a lot of space to talk and share. Mm. And he interrupted me, and he calls me Mommy. He said, Mommy, don't do that to him. Mm. You know, like, he's been through a lot. And he just kind of checked me, like, give him some compassion, which I was surprised because they didn't always have, like, the best relationship.
Mm-hmm.
But I listened. It made me listen to him more because I know that, like, he knew something that I didn't. Mm-hmm. And I let it go. Let it go. It was that easy. I think I was 16 years old. My mama told me that, you know, Gabriel's going to prison. I talked to my pops, Alton, you know, complaining, and he just was like, let that go. And I was like, got it.
Mm.
And so I'm glad. I'm very, very glad I let it go because I didn't know that, you know, who would know that you only have a short time with somebody. And I think if I would have kept a grudge, I wouldn't have spoken with him. I wouldn't have written letters. We wouldn't have seen each other. I would have just been like, oh, that's that dude over there that, you know. I would have had all of the ways in which white people talk about black fathers in my head.
Yeah.
And believing that. And that is so just untrue.
Yeah. I wanted to also ask, how does it feel when a movement like, you know, Black Lives Matter, who are literally for black people, all black people, how does it feel when it gets backlash from the black community and people kind of say, you're not really about us, you're about other people? Do you know what I mean?
At first, it stung. It was really painful, especially when it was coming from black folks who I know would benefit a lot from Black Lives Matter and being a part of it, and also knowing that the work I'm doing isn't just for myself, you know, or my immediate community, but it's for black people around the world. And I think it was really hard to, it's been really hard to hear people sort of be like, oh, you have a gay agenda, or Black Lives Matter doesn't care about black men, they only care about black women, or
which I find just
astonishing because, let's be clear, like, the movement started because a black boy named Trayvon Martin was killed by a vigilante named George Zimmerman. Like, point blank, movement started because someone killed a black boy. So this idea that, you know, because we lift up women or queer people or, you know, trans folks, that we are all of a sudden not black, you know, it's not a black organization, I think is really disturbing. And it speaks more to people's own homophobia or their own issues around other types of black people than it does about Black Lives Matter.
I was thinking about the types of men that you portrayed and how criminalized they were before they even formed their own identity. The fact that young black boys cannot go and meet up outside without being called gangbangers. And it reminded me of, so where I live, back in the day, there'd be a bunch of boys who'd be outside. And I remember my aunt would be like, oh God, you know, because she'd had internalized the idea of, yes, black boys, when they're outside, they're up to no good.
Right.
And the police, the local police station opened up and completely wipes them away.
Of course. That's probably why they opened up.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Because there was a lot of stop and search going on. And then they were like, you know what, they're up to no good.
Yes.
And why? Because a lot of white residents were calling the police, being like, these boys are outside.
Yes.
Yeah. Having absolutely no clue what they were doing. Yes. They could just be chilling outside.
Exactly.
But they were gangbangers.
Yeah.
When a group of white boys do it, it's just, you know, boys playing.
Yes.
Mm. And how did, I guess, your mother or the women in your family deal with that? And what kind of things did they talk about with the boys? Did they, was it something that they had internalized as well? Like, you know, don't play outside. Or was it just, this is what's going to happen? And did they have that talk that a lot of black women have with their sons, just to ensure that they get home safely?
Well, there's 2 points I want to make on this question. I think the first one is that there are more similarities between black people here and the UK and over in the US than I think we sometimes think. And I think because there's a narrative that the US is worse, right? It's, or there's a narrative that the UK is not as bad, that we can often get caught up as black people in the idea that the real type of racism only exists in the U.S. Happening to black Americans. And I've because I'm, you know, the founder of a global network, and I deeply believe in the global black diaspora, I think it's always important to know what's happening in a person's country. So I know that, you know, at this point, 1,649 people have been killed in custody, police custody, you know, since 2000. And there's been no convictions. And I mean, just disgusting. I know that there's been a significant amount of black people with mental illness, you know, in this country that have been completely criminalized.
Yeah.
Sounds just like the U.S.
Yeah.
I know that, you know, black youth are 3 times more likely to be excluded from their schools. Sounds like the U.S. And so I just, I've been trying to really on this tour, I want to make sure that I'm coming not to be the American that says, it's worse in the U.S., it's bad in the U.S. But I also, what I'm trying to remind black folks, like, don't let the narrative that the U.S. is worse off, that you're better here. Because there's some shit happening here in this country to black people. And black migrants, you know. And I just think it's important that we have this conversation. I was talking to folks yesterday about the women who are on hunger strike right now at Yarlswood Detention Center. And how their hunger strike is a call to action, you know.
Yeah, I mean, they want the laws to change.
Yes,
but
yes.
That's the only way that they can draw attention to, to themselves by going on hunger strike.
Being on hunger strike. But I think it's an important moment because the value of saying another country is worse off than yours means that you don't have to deal with what's happening in that country. And that is such, you know, we have obviously Black Lives Matter here in the United Kingdom. We also have Black Lives Matter in Canada, and Canada does the same thing. You know, Canada's like, oh, we're not as bad. And so it means that Canada doesn't have to deal with its black issue, right? With its issue. So I wanted to name that. And then you asked me another question, but I went on a tangent, so I completely forgot about it.
just in terms of the talk, I guess, that black
boys. Yes.
Yeah.
So, of course, we all got the talk.
Yeah.
Not just black boys. I think that's an also important myth buster here, which is Black Lives Matter started as an intervention to an idea that we were living in a post-racial society. Mm-hmm. Obama got into office. All the white people were like, y'all got your black president. Racism's over. Like, yeah. Aren't you so happy?
Yeah.
Are you still going to try to hold me accountable? And we were like, yes, because racism isn't over. And clearly it's not, because look at this young boy. He just got killed by the state, mm-hmm. By a vigilante. But also we had to do another intervention, which was say her name.
Yes.
And say her name becomes important because the media in particular, every time we spoke to the media, they would always paraphrase our movement as Black Lives Matter, the fight to end police violence against black men.
Mm. Mm.
As if no police violence had ever happened to black women.
Black women, yeah.
And that is just so untrue. And so we started to have to name the names of black women and lift them up. The women who've been killed by the police, the women who've been killed by the state. And then obviously, you know, one of the biggest names because it's Sandra Bland.
Yeah.
And so say her name is that intervention. And the talk is for all of us. And I think part of what happens in our culture is when we start to believe what really white people tell us about our conditions, we end up practicing that. And so growing up, my mom sat us all down, all of her kids. And obviously each gender gets related to differently, right? Mm-hmm. We know that black trans women have the highest death rates, you know, highest murders per population. And so my mother would sit us down and she would, you know, talk to my brothers and talk to me and talk to my little sister. Mm-hmm. And it was just normal to be afraid of the police. It was normal to be afraid of the police. We were, you know, told to be afraid of the police, you know, always be polite. You know, to this day, when I see a police officer, I never mouth off a police officer. I think it's crazy when people do.
Mm-hmm.
Although we have the right to, you know, we actually are in our own rights to, you know, say, you know, I don't believe you should be stopping me.
Yeah.
But I still have that sort of, you know, tape in my head that's like, Patrice, be extra polite, you know, keep your hands out. I remember we got pulled over the other day, or we were driving through some police thing, and Los Angeles have checkpoints a lot. Mm-hmm. And my homegirl was in the car, and she was like, what's going on? And I was like, do not act nervous. I was like, yeah. They sense nervous. Mm. I was like, it's LAPD. Like, I got so freaked out. Yeah. And she was like, okay, what do I do? I was like, just put your hands up, girl. And if he tries to say anything, just be polite. Yeah. And I was like, whoa, I'm the founder of Black Lives Matter. And that's this is how I still feel, you know, the lack of agency. So I just, like, we all get the talk. We all are frightened by the police.
Yeah.
And it's purposeful. They want us to be scared of them.
Mm-hmm. That's how you keep them in check.
Yeah. I just wanted to quickly just move on a little bit and ask you about the books that have influenced you influenced your stance. Of course, life has influenced you and made you take the stance you have. But are there any books in particular that really opened your eyes? And
Audre Lorde's Sister Outsider.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Oh, yes.
It was my Bible book.
Mm.
I literally would take it everywhere in high school.
Mm-hmm.
Bell Hooks, Sisters of the Yam.
Mm-hmm.
I got to go back and read them because I feel like I would feel so different now. But they were such formative books. I mean, I literally would carry around those two books everywhere I went. I would like open them up. Like I would like flip through the pages, close my eyes. I'd be like, what good stuff could I get? Everything Octavia Butler. Every single book she wrote.
You know, I haven't read Kindred.
Sorry?
Is it Kindred?
Yeah, yes. Kindred.
I haven't read it.
It's so
good.
I'm so good.
I'm like, I have to read it.
Have you read Fledgling?
No.
What?
I know. No. Okay, I'm going to write. Girl? Okay, so our manager's here, and I just hope she writes these down, because I'm going to be like, can you send me copies of these?
Literally everything Octavia.
Really? I just downloaded, there's like a trilogy that she did.
Yes.
Yeah.
Have you read it?
With Bloodchild?
Yes. I just downloaded it. I need to get through that on my Kindle. But I've read Kindred.
Yeah.
I thought it was...
good?
It was... You know what's so strange? Before I came across Kindred, because it wasn't really... It was published in the UK, then it went out of print for a long time.
Mm-hmm.
And for some reason, I don't know why I did this, but I was just Googling time travel slavery.
Like Octavia was whispering. Yeah, and
yeah, honestly, like
she was like, "You have to read." Exactly. Like, oh, wait, it is time.
I kept thinking to myself, "What would it be like if someone went back to the planet?" Yeah. Wait, I just finished watching. That's why, where they're called the Time Masters or something. They go back in time, to a plantation, and they shoot. They keep shooting the massa. So I thought someone must have written about this, and then found Kindred, read it, and I thought, wow, it's a very, very frustrating book, because I just kept saying to myself, will you just kill this guy? Just kill him. No. And she wouldn't do it.
Yeah.
You know?
That's what she does. Every book will do that to you with her, though.
Oh, really?
Oh, God.
She puts you
in such uncomfortable places.
Yes.
And it's so good.
I'm going to have an Octavia Butler season.
Yes.
Yeah.
I think I'm going to do that. That's because I've always wanted to, and the time had never presented itself.
Yeah,
so
yeah.
I'm going to do it.
You could just literally take her literature for a year and read all her books, and she's such a roadmap, roadmap for Black folks. And because she's from the area, I grew up in LA County, is huge as hell. Mm-hmm. It's 10 million people. So, but she grew up in LA County, so she references books and she references like a bunch of stuff.
Yeah.
That's super amazing.
Mm.
Okay, I know what to read now. I'm so excited.
Yeah.
All right.
So just
wrapping up this section
here.
I want it to be a bit more hopeful. I feel like we had a bit of a very deep moment.
Yeah.
And now I want it to be a bit more hopeful.
I mean, obviously being part of the Black Lives Matter movement and then writing this book and then having to go on a book tour, and literally you must have to relive
everything
over and over again. Does it not get to a point where you're just like, okay, I can't do anything for a week?
I got a vacation schedule for myself and my family.
Yeah.
In
May.
Do you know where you're going?
Yeah, Myrtle Beach.
Oh, where is that?
It's a little beach town in the South.
Mm.
Okay.
It's cute.
Yeah.
South Carolina.
I am. Where is? What state is New Orleans in? Because I'm really dumb.
Louisiana.
Well, I'm going there.
That's amazing.
I'm coming in July for Essence Fest.
I'll be there.
Oh, hey, girl.
Yeah, we should do a mostly lit.
Oh,
Essence.
My God. Yes. I'm down for it. Literally, it's my first time going. Like,
you're going to get your whole life.
So we're trying to do girls trip. So I've got a few friends who are there.
You're
going to
get your whole entire life.
Okay. I'm excited.
Oh, I'm excited for you.
Yeah. Oh, okay.
My family's from out in Louisiana.
Really?
They're from Eunice. They're from a little rural town, like 2 hours something.
Yeah.
Of New Orleans.
I think they should invite me for dinner.
Yeah,
we should.
I'd be like,
I got family there.
I want to eat some food, some nice New Orleans.
Just quickly going back to Sister Outside, though.
Yeah.
What was it about that book that kind of resonated with you to the point you're carrying it around with you everywhere?
Amazingly. Well, because Audre Lorde becomes the first Black lesbian who's like talking about Black radical politics and talking about the intersections, and it felt like she wrote the book for my 16-year-old self.
Mm.
I needed to hear another Black, I don't identify as lesbian, I identify as queer, but another Black woman who was not a heterosexual, that was like talking about self-care as a radical act, who was talking about Blackness, and she's such a beautiful writer. Such a beautiful writer. So her words would just like stick to like my chest every time I read them. And I, you know, when you're like a teenager, you're dramatic. So
everything's over the top.
Exactly. Everything. You feel all the feelings. And she just made me feel all the feelings, and she made me feel affirmed in who I was. And because Sister Outsider is a set of essays.
Yeah.
So every essay was just on point what I needed as a kid.
Mm,
I think I might go back to read it. It's on my shelf.
I know. I'm like, I gotta go back to read it.
Yeah, I'm gonna do it.
So one thing that I read in the book, and I was kind of like, it was a really, I don't know why, it was just, because obviously I read a lot of fiction, and the depictions are always like, you know, straight white men and whatnot. There's a bit where you're talking about when you first laid eyes on
Mr. Johnson. Mark Anthony?
Mark Anthony, yeah. And you're kind of just like, what the fuck? Why am I... this is a straight cis man. Why am I attracted to him like that? Do you know what I mean? And so because obviously you said that you always knew you were, you know, you were queer
yeah.
as well. Was what kind? What would you call that moment?
So that's a very good question. And what I would come to realize is that my queerness. So I grew up at a time where in my high school, and I have no idea, like we were all drinking a certain kind of water, but I literally, like 20 of us all came out at the same time, like 20 women of color, queer women of color. A lot of us got either kicked out of our homes or pushed out of our homes mm-hmm. or left our homes for safety reasons, but we became each other's family. And we all were sort of like unveiling our identities, you know, our multiple identities. And so I was very, like, I remember when I first came out, I was like, I'm a lesbian. Like, I never, like, I was very, like a very, like, you know, screaming, like, lesbian. Yeah. And then I started to realize, like, oh, I actually, like, love everybody. Like, and so for a long time, because I read Emma Goldman, that you should all read Emma mm. Goldman. So I started to identify as a free lover. And I think that irritated my teachers a lot. Like, what the hell is a free lover, Patrice? But this is me at 16.
Yeah.
I burned my bra at 16. That's I mean, I was right. wild. I was a wild 16-year-old. I shaved my head. My mom was crying her eyeballs out. I did a whole thing. I went through a whole transformation. And so I started to realize, like, oh, no, I'm a free lover. And then I got over that category. And I started to read queer theory and queer politics. I started realizing, oh, I'm actually queer, and what I'm most interested in is challenging cisnormativity, heteronormativity. Mm-hmm. And my relationship, even though it was with a heterosexual, even though Marty Kathy doesn't identify as heterosexual, even though it was with a cis man, was a queer relationship.
Right.
And so the idea of queerness is much more evolved mm-hmm. and becomes much more evolved as I get older and I realize, oh, I cis men aren't the first human beings I'm attracted to,
yeah.
but I can be attracted to them. And I would probably, like, if I were, like, on a panel and someone was like, well, what do you identify with outside of queer? I would probably say I'm pansexual,
mm-hmm. right?
Which is, like, you know, many genders. I'm attracted to many genders and many identities.
How's the sort of American representation in the media evolving or changing with regards to queer identity? Because I feel like... I think when I was reading British, there was a part where Shonda was like, well, you know what? Everyone's questioning me about why I'm so passionate about putting on these identities on television.
Right.
And there's this, like, people are thinking there is this obsession with me.
with, like, queer people.
Exactly. Like, everyone has to be a lesbian or a gay man.
There's a gay agenda.
Right. Exactly.
Right. Yeah. And she was like, I don't understand why people are talking to me about this, because when you think about it, I'm just trying to make this the normal, because it is.
Because
the normal.
It is.
It is a reflection.
There's so many queer people and trans people.
So I'm like, why are these not being put in the media? And is that changing right now? I mean, Shonda is kind of really holding
She's
the gun with it.
Game.
She's trying really hard. But is it being picked up?
Yeah, because it's interesting. I think Shonda has done a very good job. And I remember, you know, with Grey's Anatomy and her and the coming out of Callie. That's not on the show anymore.
Calliope. Oh, man, I miss her.
I know, me too. And I was like, thank God.
Yeah.
Thank God it's something that's not, like, because we had the L word growing up, you know? So we would all, like, pile in my living room, all the queer kids, and we'd watch the L word, because that was the only shit we had. But the L word was terrible.
Mm.
It was, like, about a bunch of white, mostly rich lesbians. Mm-hmm. We none of us lived like that. Like, didn't make any sense, but it was the only representation.
I remember that show, yeah.
So I think Shonda has done a better job at, trying to be like, this is who people are.
Yeah.
And then I think Queen Sugar is doing an interesting job at that. Ava DuVernay's show, she has a queer character, and she brought on a trans man character. Mm-hmm. But it's still not enough, especially black characters. Like,
they're
still
just diamond, like, not 3D, very much still doing that black role, the best friend,
the person
that dies first.
Exactly. Like, I'm looking forward to, like, when a queer woman of color is, like, the lead in a show, and you get to see her friends and her relationships and how complicated it is. But that it'll happen.
Yeah.
It just ain't happening.
I think it happened in a few episodes of...
Black
Lightning. Get Away with Murder.
Oh, right, okay.
When
Viola was attracted, she literally had a relationship with this woman.
Yeah.
And I was like, yes,
Yeah.
I was
yeah.
really happy about that. Like, yeah, she's that was trying. Shonda's really...
No, she's... I think she's doing a good job. Mm-hmm. But she can't be the only one. Exactly. And she kind of is.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's taking on a lot.
Cool. Okay, well, just rounding off that section. I have no gem today, unfortunately. I'll have another one next week. But Ray, your issue
My
today.
My issue. Okay, so social media has been going absolutely wild on the fact that Bruno Mars is appropriating black music. I think he had a quote that
I'm not going to lie to you. I thought Bruno Mars was mixed race.
I thought Bruno Mars was mixed race, but I feel like he is, but is he black?
You feel like he is, but is he though?
Okay, I don't
know. Is he? Everyone's googling like, is Bruno Mars mixed?
Is he mixed?
I think I've googled this several times.
Yeah.
He's like, there's Hispanic, there's a lot of, but anyway, so he said something. He said, mm-hmm. When you say black music, understand that you are talking about rock, jazz, R&B, reggae, funk, doo-wop, hip-hop, and Motown. Black people created it, or even salsa music stems back to the motherland, Africa. So in my world, black music means everything.
Okay.
Okay, so that's what he says.
Yeah.
And people are going crazy, saying, well, you know what? You're winning all of these awards,
yeah.
but you're not really what? Paying homage still, or saying...
But that is paying homage.
Okay, but my own thing is, I think this argument is whack, right? I feel like, personally...
It sounds like an All Lives Matter argument, I'm
yeah.
just saying.
I feel like... I don't know, because I quite like Bruno Mars.
Yeah.
And I don't know what he needs... Like, what does he need to do?
When did people start saying this? I mean, when he came with, you know, that Grenade song, his first album and whatnot, were people really saying this?
No, they
or
weren't.
Or is it this funk thing they're not really feeling?
Yeah. It's the funk thing.
Yeah.
Right. It's what's happening now and what he's winning awards for now,
yeah.
I think.
Yeah.
Because, you know, like, Grammys, he dominated that this year. So
what are people saying they want him to do?
This is it. Like, this is the question. What can he do?
You know that Twitter don't tell you what to do. It
no,
just
they just rant about it, right?
Yeah.
And it reminded me, of Keith's, what's her name? Rita Ora here.
Yes.
And I thought Rita Ora was mixed race, like, when I was younger.
Oh, yeah, yeah. But she's...
She's not black at all.
Yeah, she's not. She's European. She's
Eastern
European.
Yeah. But I was like, yeah, girl, like, homegirl, you know, like, she's a black woman, but
yeah.
that's not it. But I'm like, okay, what do you guys want Bruno Mars to do?
I think, I mean, I understand.
Do you want him to have, like, latest song is, you know, inspired by it?
Yeah. Yeah.
And then play the song.
I mean, I understand it. I mean, I get the argument.
Yeah, I get the argument.
But I think when the arguments come from Twitter, they really pick and choose who they, do you know what I mean? Like, somebody like Adele, she's a great singer. But someone made the point that loads of black women can sing like that.
Mm.
And
they're not getting
the attention that Adele is getting. Do you know what I mean? Mm. But there's no onslaught on Adele.
There's not, because she's a national treasure.
Well, exactly. Do you know what I mean? I completely understand the argument. Yeah. You know, when you get people like James Bay who really say, oh, it's just music. It's not black music. And we're giving MOBO awards to Jennifer Lopez and stuff like that. It's a bit weird. It's a bit weird, but... I get the argument, but like you said, Twitter just tells you what's wrong with the world. They don't tell you how to fix it. So
that was my issue today, Bruno. I don't know what you can do, but maybe just say where your music is inspired from.
He's inspired you, yeah.
So
okay, cool.
That's my issue.
Cool. Well, coming to the end of the show.
Man, we really enjoyed having you here.
Yeah, thanks a lot for coming.
I'm all emotional. And I'm all for it. And thank you so much.
Thank you for having me.
Yeah. When are you leaving?
Next Friday.
Right, okay.
I leave on Saturday, like, but the tour ends Friday.
Tour ends Friday.
I was actually going to say she leaves next Friday, and then I realized, I probably know too much information.
Yeah. I appreciate
you. Yeah, let her say it.
Are you coming back for the paperback, yeah?
Ooh, oh, please do.
I don't know. It depends on the team if they want me to.
Oh, okay. Well, we'll
please
talk to your team.
And we'll talk to your team.
Try to sort something out, yeah.
Is that a thing? People do another course for their paperback?
Yeah, of course. Yeah.
She's coming back, guys.
Yeah.
It's going to be a sponsored by Mostly Lit trip, okay? But no, thank you so much. Where can they find you if anybody wants to find you on social media? Like, whereabouts?
I'm at... OSOPEPATRISSE. My mom switched it up. Patrice is spelled with two S's, not an E. On Twitter and Instagram. I'm on Twitter for sure, but I love Insta.
Yeah.
Like, that's where I roll. And I also have a Facebook page, but you know, who really does that? Yeah. But you can like my public figure page. It's on there, Patrice Colors. Perfect. And I have a website, patricecolors.com, where I show all the latest, my art, because I'm also an artist. Mm-hmm. The work that I'm doing, you can follow me there.
Yeah, cool.
Thank you.
And the book is called When They Call You a Terrorist.
A Black Lives Matter memoir.
Yeah, published by Canongate Books.
Yes.
Yay. Great. Thank you so much, guys. You know where to find us, at Mostly Lit on Twitter, at Mostly Lit Pod on Instagram. You can find us all individually. I'm at Reckless Ray. And Derek, do you finally have a Twitter?
Yes, I'm at Guardian Derek.
Okay, thank you.
Finally have a Twitter.
You can find Alex also. He'll be back hopefully in the coming week. Thank you so much for listening.
Thank you.
And bye.
Bye, guys.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.